Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and examine why the President is not standing up to the blackmail by the Republican leadership, who are threatening to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States unless they get their way in cutting Social Security and Medicare, while they refuse to even consider raising revenues, let alone taxing the top 1%. The Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, Robert Johnson, joins us to explain why the President is not standing with the American people. Then, amid strikes and protests, with the Greek Parliament poised to make austerity measures required by European banks and bondholders to avoid default, we will discuss the Greek economic and political crisis with Theofanis Stavrou, who is Professor of History at the University of Minnesota and founder and editor of the Journal of Modern Greek Studies. Then finally, we'll look into the wars between law enforcement that are bound to resurface with the trial of alleged mobster Whitey Bulger, who was just arrested in Santa Monica. Maria Kramer, who covers crime for the Boston Globe, joins us. She was in court today in Boston as Whitey Bulger arrived in an orange jumpsuit to face a federal judge at the beginning of his long and painful trial that promises to be embarrassing for the FBI. I'm now joined by Robert Johnson, who serves as the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and is a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz. Previously, Robert Johnson was a managing director of Soros Fund Management and was chief economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and senior economist of the United States Senate Budget Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
Thanks for having me on.
Clearly, at least to my mind, maybe you can unconfuse me if that's the correct term here. I don't understand why President Obama is negotiating in good faith with the Republicans who are using this idea of the United States defaulting because of the August the 2nd deadline on raising the debt limit. They're using that as leverage in their negotiations with him. And most economists say it's crazy even to have such a debt limit. No other country has it. Yet it's being taken seriously, apparently, by the White House. And to my mind, the analogy is somebody's, soaking themselves in gasoline, threatening to light a match. And instead of putting a fire hose on them, you're saying, well, we're saying, or Obama's saying, wait a minute, let me put some gasoline on myself and then we'll talk.
Well, I think there are a lot of different ways to approach this problem. First of all, we have to acknowledge that in the United States, for whatever reason, the debt limit negotiations are real, and that one body of our legislature or whoever who refuses to pass a debt limit can do a great deal of harm. Secondly, the president seems quite averse, and this causes me great discomfort, to embarrass the people who are threatening to do harm to the American credit and capital markets and the American people, ultimately. But, how do I say, third cross-section, third way of seeing this, in the aftermath of the bank bailouts, with the scope and the scale of corporate welfare in America, we're in a place where many American citizens say, I would rather turn off the faucet than use my future tax dollars to support and enable the rich and the powerful. American government appears to many to have become an insurance agency for the wealthy and the powerful, and they want to shut that off. And you can see that in the polls. Going back to last July, Pew Research Institute showed this. Democrat, Republican, Independent have very similar positions. So we're in a place now, unfortunately, where I think the media is largely, yourself accepted, malfunctioning. And what we are doing is we're pretending that people who want to collect on their Social Security, which they paid into for their whole life, or people who want to collect on Medicare and Medicaid, which are very human things, are somehow the source of the problem, rather than the financial sector, the military-industrial complex, and the medical-industrial complex, which includes insurance, pharmaceuticals, and hospitals that are blowing out our budgets and making our health care far too expensive. We're in a dreadful place where we're not taking on power and we're pretending that citizens' reasonable demands are the problem.
But Robert Johnson, you have just made the case that the President of the United States should make. But conversely, he is buying into this threat of this Samson-like threat that we're going to pull the whole temple down. Why not call the Republicans on that bluff? Because it is, by any measure, completely irresponsible. And I can't imagine that even the Tea Party wing is going to prevail in that. Wouldn't it force the Republicans, if you called their bluff, wouldn't it force them to get real?
In my opinion and in my heart, I'm very disappointed in the president that he's not showing more spine than going after this challenge on exactly the terms that you suggest. On the other hand, if I had his job and I had to raise $1 billion in this completely dysfunctional money politics of the United States, I would be concerned about doing good policy because essentially in order to get elected, he's got to please roughly 2% of our population. And mostly what they want is subsidies to multinational enterprise and to keep their taxes low. Well-educated and healthy Americans that have health care and a school system are of almost no value now to a large proportion of that 2% of Americans that really matter in the money politics of raising $1 billion and getting reelected.
But Robert Johnson, when you talk of the money politics, does that mean that all businessmen, and I imagine predominantly they're Republicans, are that ideological, that they would go along with a kind of Tea Party strategy? I spoke with Bruce Bartlett the other day, and he railed against the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party and said, it's no longer my party. And he literally, I'm quoting him, he said, these people are insane. So I don't get it. Why would the 2% favor this kind of ridiculous blackmail?
Well, I think the 2% have private, they can pay for health insurance, they have private education, they have private security, and most of their workforce is overseas. Maybe that's a little too dark, because I believe that many, many major corporate figures in the United States now are in a place which is what you might call a dilemma between their role in representing shareholders and making money for themselves on the one hand, and their role as citizens who are born in the United States and, how we say, loyal to their country on the other hand. But at least in recent years, it appears that the money-making role has taken precedence over their role as citizens. You do not see people, for the large part, in corporate America, standing up as private citizens, advocating a rebuilding of science research, education, and infrastructure in the United States, and tolerating a rise in their taxes.
Well, it's true that, except I suppose people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett have made some pretty strong statements. In Warren Buffett's case, he said that the United States is in danger of becoming a plantation economy. We're talking about the hollowing out of the middle class here. And when you said earlier, Robert Johnson, that you felt that polls indicate that the majority of the people do not want this country to become a plutonomy. They want the American dream. They want a country based on a thriving middle class. You would think that that would be a winning campaign strategy. But I guess what you're saying is that the president has to count upon the 2% for his free re-election funds, not the 98%.
Well, I would say that Warren Buffett, George Soros, who you know I used to work with, Bill Gates and his father, wrote a wonderful book called Wealth in the Commonwealth about the inheritance tax. These people are the exceptions to the rule. And I think they are very concerned. Warren Buffett's given very, very lucid testimony in many instances about how the role of things like public libraries were the rungs in the ladder of his own development. And if he'd been born in a place like Bangladesh, he never could have achieved what he did. But I don't think we experience a great deal of people understanding the relationship between economy and society and the dreadful consequences for society and kind of hostility that arises, like in Europe in the 1930s after their banking crisis. People treat the economy like it's a mechanistic function. And so those people who are the most successful, like Soros, like Buffett, like Gates, part of the reason they're successful is they can see forward. They can see consequences that other people don't imagine. And they are striking a different tone than the large body of people who are fundraising or supporting something that's essentially a policy that's, how do I say, no deeper and no more powerful than just keep my taxes low. And that's really a testament to the lack of faith in the American government. In America, people will not succeed without public goods, without infrastructure, without the things that we all depend on. And no major industrial developed society does well without those things. On the other hand, people are right, very right, to be distrustful of the government and the way it's behaved in the last, say, 15 years. And how do we regain that trust? How do we build those, which you might call collective interests and actions that make us all better off? We do, how did I say, struggle to find that place now. And right now, despondency and distrust is in the driver's seat. And I think we're all being corrosively harmed by that.
And Robert Johnson, do you think that given the quality of the debate about deficits versus revenues, and obviously logically the only way to pay down a deficit or a debt is with revenues, but revenues are off the table as far as the Republicans are concerned, and they've turned the deficit situation into the clear and present danger and a crisis. However, this tax argument, one of the candidates running on the Republican side, Tim Pawlenty, is actually even talking about more taxes, and he's saying that this, if you cut taxes even further, you'll have a 5% growth rate per annum into the glorious future. And frankly, it makes absolutely no sense. And I'm wondering whether the debate is so corrupted now that rational discourse is even possible here, that faith has replaced fact in our political environment.
I would go to a different use of the language. I largely agree with you, but I would say distrust has replaced expertise, so that the idea of facts, what one person asserts the facts to be, is, as you know from debates on climate science, 90-some percent of the people who claim that global warming is a problem, but there are 4%, some of whom are essentially lobbyist PhDs, who have no scholarly record, representing that this is all a mirage or a fantasy. And they are able, with large marketing budgets, somewhat supported by the energy companies, to, how would I say, sow the seeds of doubt. So expertise in the financial sector, if one's seen the Academy Award-winning film Inside Job, you can see that nobody trusts financial experts because they just drove us off a cliff. On climate change, nobody trusts experts. People have spent 25 years before they woke up the idea that inequality is pervasive and overwhelming in America, where between 1978 and the present, let's call it 2010, where the data ends, the top 1.5% of the population has taken more than 100% of the gains in GDP growth, and everybody else is worse off. Economists have not reported these things. They have not acknowledged these things. They've not studied reality. They've conformed to power and ideology. And the public is right not to trust pseudo or pretend or whatever ritualistically acknowledged expertise, because it isn't representing them. It isn't playing a fair game. So the whole place is spoiled, and false visionaries like Pawlenty and others have a lot of running room right now. And I think it's quite a sad, quite a tragic circumstance. But you're exactly right. Real ideas and real facts get no traction because the level of distrust is so high.
Again, I'm speaking with economist Robert Johnson, who is the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. You know, the one voice that I hear, and I guess in many ways he's becoming the conscience of the United States Senate, is Senator Bernie Sanders, who on the floor of the Senate said, in his view, the President of the United States of America needs to stand with the American people and say to the Republican leadership that enough is enough. No, we will not balance the budget on the backs of working families, the elderly, the sick, the children, and the poor, who have already sacrificed enough in terms of lost jobs, lost wages, lost homes, and lost pensions. Yes, we will demand that millionaires and billionaires and the largest corporations in America contribute to deficit reduction as a matter of shared sacrifice. Yes, we will reduce unnecessary and wasteful spending at the Pentagon. And no, we will not be blackmailed once again by the Republican leadership in Washington, who are threatening to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States government for the first time in our nation's history unless they get everything they want. You know, when you listen to Bernie Sanders' words, you realize It is. It's like the Republicans are like, a teenager having a tantrum, wanting everything.
Let me take it to a different place. Bernie Sanders is a great American citizen. Because of the structure of politics in Vermont, he's able to speak the truth. And everything that you just quoted from him is extraordinary in the sense that it authentically represents the American people. But this isn't just the Republicans. You've got a whole lot of smarmy people in the Democratic Party on banking committees and budget committees and finance committees and so forth that created a lousy, corporate-subsidized health care bill that puts America into a budget crisis because it pays about 6% of GDP more than any other country, and America's health care quality is rated 38th in the world by the World Health Organization. You have a whole lot of Democrats who are culpable for doing inadequate and basically pathetic ritualistic attempts at financial reform because you have a broken money politics system and the health care system and the health care industries and the financial industries and the military industries are dominant in the setting of our social priorities. And to go back to President Obama, it would be nice if he would stand up to these people in this fight, except he needs to survive as what Ralph Nader calls the least worst alternative. He needs to raise $1 billion from those same industry groups I just mentioned. So this isn't a Republican or a Democrat problem. This is a social problem of incentives and the structure of our government's broken. And everybody knows that. And some of the people in the Tea Party are just as fed up with Democrats as they are with Republicans. And I don't blame them.
There's no question, Robert Johnson, that when you refer to the Dodd-Frank bill, which, by the way, the Federal Reserve head from Kansas City just came out saying that Dodd-Frank is absolutely useless. The banks are still too big to fail, and nothing was done to lessen that looming threat that it'll all happen again. And when you refer to the Democrats in terms of so-called health care reform, what I find, again, not wanting to beat up on the president, I understand the situation he's in because it is our politics are money driven. However, in terms of a negotiator, I don't understand why they come in asking for less than not more. Any Hollywood agent out here where I'm speaking will tell you, you always ask for more and settle for less, you know?
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm very, very disappointed in Barack Obama's sensibilities about negotiating tactics. I've been very disappointed that he appointed a J.P. Morgan executive to run the White House staff in the aftermath of financial reform. But I also would say I'm not so much disappointed in him as a person as what you might call respectful of his intelligence. What I'm very disappointed in the structure of money politics in America. He's responding rationally and intelligently to a failing system. And it's really incumbent upon people like you and me and 290 million other Americans to not tolerate that system, not tolerate the Supreme Court decisions on Citizens United, and put the incentives back in alignment where a basically intelligent man like Barack Obama can be bolder in doing the right thing instead of kowtowing to do the wrong thing in order to survive.
Well, just in closing, Robert Johnson, do you think that the president should take heed of the advice he's getting from President Clinton? After all, when President Clinton left office, this country had an annual federal budget surplus of $236 billion with projected budget surpluses as far as the eye could see. And just, you know, in the short interregnum with George W. Bush, he alone contributed to one-third of the entire national debt. And if you add his father and Ronald Reagan to that mix, that's over one-half of the entire debt that the United States has run up since the beginning of the Republic. So you would think that the Republicans, with those statistics, would the last thing they'd be talking about would be the national debt. But they've managed to put that in the center of the debate, not jobs. And that's basically what Clinton is saying. You know, let's talk about jobs. Let's inspire the country and get it working again.
Well, I believe that the question of accumulating debt with no assets, meaning there's nothing on the other side of the balance sheet, is something everyone can be against. Bill Clinton's exactly right to say that if you're going to borrow, you got to create something with it. You got to create productivity, education, infrastructure, science, research, jobs. Idle resources don't pay taxes. One of the weirdest things about this move towards austerity all over the world is that they're leaving 10, 15, 20% of the capable, viable resources on the sidelines while they're worrying about the deficit. Even Larry Summers has said in my presence at Davos, the best thing you can do is put people back to work and move the unemployment rate to 5% in order to reduce the deficit. And this, what I will call Andrew Mellon liquidationist frenzy, is really, really counterproductive, even given the goals of those people who are concerned about the debt. So I think Bill Clinton is right on track. I do think the Republicans have had a conscious strategy of running large deficits and running the debt into a place where we would have a train wreck, and things that were largely, and you know, I worked with the Roosevelt Institute, New Deal programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, would be run up against these, what you might call boundaries or psychological boundaries of fear of indebtedness, and then they would be eradicated or broken down or greatly diminished. I think that's wrong. I think the most successful societies in the world provide education, science, research, adequate regulation, education. Countries like Germany and Sweden are doing an awful lot better than America right now. And many Americans are very, very jealous, very anxious about China. China is not tearing apart its public sector. It's investing in infrastructure, science, and education at a much, much more powerful and vigorous pace than the United States. We're not losing to our competitors and then learning from our competitors. We're pretending the only thing that matters is cutting taxes for rich people, and I think that's just foolish.
I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Robert Johnson. Again, I thank you for joining us.
I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Thank you. And I've been speaking with Robert Johnson, who serves as the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He's a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. And he was formerly the Chief Economist of the United States Senate's Banking Committee and the Senior Economist of the United States Senate Budget Committee. We'll take a short break and we'll be back talking about the Greek crisis.
In the big old federal government, SEC is blind as bats, and the cash cow keeps producing like rabbits out of hats. The president makes good speeches, and the press corps plays along. Oh, I'm bound to go where there's lots of dough, where reality don't show, and the congressmen blow in the big old federal government. In the big old
σκοτάδια και πέφτουν τα παιδιά μας. Δεν βρίσκω άκρη, τρόπο ή ελπίδα, όμως τα χέρια την τύχη μου κρατώ.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm now joined by Theofanis Stavrou, who is a professor of history and Near Eastern Studies at the University of Minnesota. His books include Redefining Southeastern Europe, Political Challenges and Economic Opportunities, and Greece Prepares for the 21st Century. He's also the founder and editor of the journal Modern Greek Studies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Theofanis Stavrou.
Very glad to be with you.
And clearly the Greek music you were just listening to is a little too joyful, I think, for the occasion here at hand. The Financial Times is reporting in a conversation with the governor of the Bank of Greece, George Provolopoulos, that Greece, if this vote before the parliament fails, Greece will be committing suicide. What's your sense of the moment?
Well, there is no doubt that this is one of the most serious crises the country has faced. The general impression in the country, however, is that it will pass. even though today there were all kinds of demonstrations again, and many of them are really quite disturbing. As of this evening, at least, I happened to speak to a few individuals, and without wanting to make a commitment, they feel that the debate will get approved by the Greek parliament, even though one of the people who defected was a member of PASOK.
Well, I believe by now there's two defectors from PASOK, but they had five. They had a majority of five, so they're down to a majority of three. But I think what's really telling in this surely is that the conservative opposition, who caused the debt crisis in the first place, are refusing to cooperate with the government. And I believe that the European conservative parties and throughout Europe are leaning on the Greek opposition, but they're just being political opportunists, as far as I can tell.
That's the way it looks. But on the other hand, they are even really more willing to cooperate than it meets the eye, because they know it is political suicide. I think the main thing that you're talking, when you speak about Conservative Party, you are talking about the New Democracy, I take it. And these are the people whom, of course, PASOK had ejected out of office. But the fact does remain that New Democracy and the people who are critical of this new arrangement is not that they are not aware of the crisis of the situation, or that they know they have to satisfy the demands of the outsiders, but they are critical of the taxation more than anything else, which is not really all that difficult from what we hear from conservatives in this country when it comes to meeting some of the problems that we have. In other words, taxation remains the number one problem in Greece, and tax evasion, in other words.
Well, actually, I'm talking about the Conservative Party and its leader, Antonis Samaras.
That's right.
He's the person that the European Conservative Parties have been pleading with to cooperate. Now, clearly, there's a lot of moral hazard to go around in this situation. Goldman Sachs helped the former Conservative government of Greece hide its sovereign debt. And as you just pointed out, the real problem in Greece is that people don't pay their taxes. How pervasive is that? Is it just the rich, or
it's extremely pervasive? And I really think the Greeks themselves recognize that as being the number one problem in the country. And I think one of the problems facing the country, and one which we fail to understand, by we, I mean outsiders who do not live in Greece, is that the Greeks have really lived under tough times before, and they have survived. In fact, I cannot think of another small European country that has suffered as much ever since it became an independent state in the middle of the beginning of the 19th century. They've always lived very frugally, and I think what we fail to understand, however, is that ever since Greece became part of the European Union, but even after the Second World War, it has been sort of a workshop, really, of some of the problems facing Europe. Right after the war, it was a civil war. There was the struggle between the right and the left. Then we had the problem of the Cold War. But Greece also experienced a tremendous economic boom in the 50s and 60s, and that was oftentimes referred to as the economic miracle. And the Greeks learned to live rather well, but they did not begin to live the way Western Europeans and Americans really taught them to live until in the mid-80s and 90s. And I think what I'm really trying to say is that the Greeks were very frugal. They would pay their way as they moved along. Maybe it took them 15 years to build a house, but when it was built, it was paid for. Then suddenly, the new arrangement becomes part of their experience, where they can really borrow against the possibility of paying in the future. Now, when this is extended, not just to money to keep the government going, but to even make a healthy, good living, and then suddenly that is threatened of being taken away from you, and then on top of that, to bail out your own government, which has been borrowing maybe recklessly, this is really the psychological frame in which you put the modern Greek, and that's one reason they are showing this kind of frustrations, both in the streets and in the parliament. Now, I think there's another extremely important point that we have to keep in mind, that this economic boom that I mentioned, or miracle that Greece experienced, based chiefly on foreign aid and also on tourism in the 60s and 70s and what have you, this, nevertheless, had very unfortunate effect of really allowing the Greeks to neglect basic institutions all the way from governing the entire political system, educational system, and things of this sort. And so when we are talking about the Europeans and we are thinking about the economic problem, because that's visible, that's something that's tangible, but really the country is in need of overhauling. The whole system has to be dealt with rather ruthlessly, I maintain, and only then the economic problem will be dealt with.
Again, I'm speaking with University of Minnesota Professor Theofanis Stavrou, who is the founder and editor of the journal Modern Greek Studies. And the aid package that's being voted on Wednesday and Thursday, and it's, you know, they're hanging by a thread in terms of the socialist government's thin majority in passing this package, and it's, the streets are full of angry people, there are massive demonstrations, some of them very violent today, and there's a group of people that are camped out that are basically protesting this. They call themselves the Indignant Citizens Movement, and so it's a very, very volatile political situation. But it all comes down to a simple fact, which I don't think our press report very often, and that is that the money that's being asked for, this $40 billion, a part of a 110 million euro package, a sort of down payment, if you will, that money is to pay off the European banks and bondholders. It is not going to the Greek people. Instead, the Greek people are being asked to make further sacrifices to pay back this money, but the money is not going to them. And I don't understand why it is that the banks and the bondholders, you were saying that the government borrowed recklessly. Well, the banks and the bondholders lent recklessly. And even Angela Merkel recently said maybe the bondholders should have more skin in the game, as they say in American football.
Well, I think your analysis is absolutely right on the money, as if I may use that expression. And the fact does remain that the European bankers and institutions always are very fond of loaning money, especially to either new governments or developing countries. This is nothing new. And as long as they can collect their money, then they are perfectly happy. And now, because of the international crisis and the economic crisis we are all facing, it has become evident that perhaps really the Greek political and economic system will not be able to pay the interest, not to say anything about the loan itself. But and I think that's one of the reasons why the Greek people are really very upset. I said earlier they're upset because they have to pay for the debts that the government incurred, because everybody knows that the Greek government bureaucracy is huge. And I think that's where some of the most important cuts have to be made. And any institution that the government supports, including a lot of industries that they subsidize, that's one reason privatization of some of these industries has become such an important issue. But I guess the point I am trying to make is that the Greek people, and I read very carefully the speech that Evangelos Venizelos, the new Minister of Finance, made yesterday. And I must say I was quite impressed by, first of all, acknowledging that that everybody has a role in this, and everybody is at fault in the sense that they have all made mistakes. He acknowledged the tax evasion, that is very serious. He acknowledged the need for revamping the entire political and economic system, but especially the economic system. And he believes that in the next 4 or 5 years, in other words, this interim period up to 2015, he believes that really the country, if it re-educates itself, that's an extremely important word, and enter a new culture, which I know many people say you cannot do it overnight, but I go back to my early statement that the Greeks lived a little bit too happily under the economic boom of the 50s and 60s and 70s, and I think now they have to pay the piper. And indeed, many responsible people, and people like Mr. Venizelos, I am very, very impressed by what he had to say. And he is trying to impress upon the Greeks that they all have to show in the next 3 or 4 years that they really can work together with the people who loaned them the money. These are money that has come into the country. They borrowed. They have to pay them in the long run. They are realistic that they cannot pay them right away. And Greece is going to be in debt for many, many years. It's been in debt, really, ever since it came into existence. But the question is, the crucial issue is to prove to the Europeans that they really can behave well in the next 3 or 4 years. And that, in fact, and this is extremely important, the Greeks want to get out of this position of humiliation and embarrassment in which the present crisis, internationalized, has really made them look even worse than they may be.
Well, in the last minute here, Theophanis Stavrou, apparently the Greek looks like it will need, and Greece looks like it will need another financial rescue. Papandreou, the prime minister, has said that a second bailout would be roughly the same size as the first, but hopefully on better terms. And that means that the second rescue package after this painful one will be around the same size of 110 billion euros. Now, a lot of economists think that Greece is heading for a default simply because of its overall 340 billion euro debt burden, and that's too great. So you're optimistic. Just in the last minute, explain why you think it'll...
I am optimistic. Optimism, somebody said, is good for breakfast, is not good for dinner. But I'm optimistic in the sense that really countries, states... they don't just disappear. I think the Greeks may go into deeper troubles, but ultimately they'll have to shoulder the responsibility of getting out of the mess in which either they or their government put them. They're hardworking people. I think they are talented people. They're well-educated people. I believe that they are, in some respects, the first country that is both European and Southeastern European and Mediterranean. So there is a dynamism there that I don't really discount because suddenly the international crisis made the Europeans want to care for their investment in Greece. And also because they're afraid that if Greece defaults, there will be other domino effect.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, but I thank you so much for joining us here today, Theophanis Stavrou.
You're welcome.
Again, Theophanis Stavrou is Professor of History and Near Eastern Studies at the University of Minnesota. He's also the founder and editor of the journal Modern Greek Studies. We're going to take a brief station break now and we'll be back talking about the recent FBI triumph in arresting Whitey Bulger, which may end up being followed by embarrassment for the FBI.
Στην ίδια παγίδα ξανά για ακόμα μια φορά. Κανένας δεν
δεν θέλει να μάθει την αλήθεια. Πως μπορείς μέσα και υλικό αλλάζεις σε μια...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Maria Kramer, who covers crime for the Boston Globe. She has been in the Boston courtroom where alleged mobster Whitey Bulger has appeared before a judge. Welcome to Background Briefing, Maria Kramer.
Thank you.
And today, what happened in the courtroom?
Today, James Whitey Bulger showed up in the courtroom wearing an orange prison uniform. This is the first time we've seen him in a prison uniform. And he sat before Judge Wolf, who is a federal judge, who now has to decide whether to approve a motion by the prosecution to dismiss racketeering charges against Whitey Bulger. These were the first charges that were made against Whitey Bulger, and this was done in 1995. Now, the reason that it appears the prosecution is doing this is so that they can move on to the much more serious and I think much more easy to prove charges of murder against Whitey Bulger. As you know, Whitey Bulger is accused of killing or ordering the killings of 19 people.
And he's been on the lam, what, for 16 years?
Yes, he's been on the lam since late 1994. He basically left because he was tipped off that he was going to be indicted. And ever since then, he has been on the run. Now he is finally back in Boston.
Well, I imagine a lot of people are happy to see justice done, but I'm assuming that the FBI is uncomfortable with this all along, given the extraordinary story of this FBI officer, John Connolly, who was Bulger's protector all those years. And, of course, John Connolly is serving 40 years for his double dealing.
Basically, yes. I mean, John Connolly serving 40 years, and one of the charges against him were murder. This was the murder of a Florida man John Connolly was accused of tipping off Whitey Bulger that he was going to be testifying against him. So Whitey Bulger had him killed.
So give us,
like you said, this is a strange time for the FBI. On the one hand, they can celebrate him finally being captured, but on the other, it's a very painful reminder of the corruption that really plagued the Boston office, the Boston field office of the FBI for so long.
Well, it seemed, if I'm correct, Maria Kramer, again, she covers crime for the Boston Globe and has been in the courthouse witnessing the arrival in a orange jumpsuit of Whitey Bulger, who's been on the lam for 16 years. Mm-hmm. My understanding, though, is that what's at the heart of this story is a kind of war, if you will, within the police, between the Massachusetts State Police and the FBI. And, of course, that Martin Scorsese made a film, I think, in part based on it. But the hero in this, of course, is Tom Foley, isn't he? Who was head of the Massachusetts State Police, and the villain, apart from Bulger himself, is this retired FBI agent now in prison, John Connolly.
Well, I mean, I think it's probably a little bit more complex than that. You know, I mean, John Connolly was certainly not the only one in the FBI who looked the other way, but Tom Foley, like you said, yes, he's one of the few law enforcement authorities in this case that really shines because he worked very hard to capture Whitey Bulger, and he also was not alone. There were several others that worked incredibly hard to get Whitey Bulger, only to see him escape their clutches.
And what is the sense then of the relationship? I mean, it's going to be uncomfortable, as I'm sure. And you mentioned earlier that one of the requirements of Bulger's attorneys was, one of the demands he made was that the government stop leaking stuff. But so is the government trying to sort of preemptively leak stuff because they are embarrassed? But surely through the course of this trial, whatever embarrassing details there are about the government's role or the FBI's role in protecting Bulger will come out.
Well, I mean, I think that you know, you could say that we were able to break stories on Sunday because we have good sources, not because the government is purposely trying to leak stuff to us. The U.S. Attorney's Office during the hearing today said that they were very concerned about the leaks and that they did not want that happening, and that they've essentially instructed all of the agencies involved not to leak any further. Shelley Murphy, who's a Boston Globe reporter who's been following this since basically the 80s, you know, she has incredible sources and was able to break a very interesting story on Sunday that, of course, did not, I don't think, please the U.S. Attorney's Office very much either. But like you said, yes, I mean, I think that everyone is anxiously looking forward to a trial to see what more might come out of the relationship that the very disturbing relationship that Whitey Bulger formed with members of the FBI back in the 80s when he was the mob boss.
Well, but doesn't his relationship with the government go back even further? Because Bulger, when he was in a federal prison for bank robbery earlier than this, he signed up and was able to get some years shaved off his sentence by taking LSD for CIA-sponsored mind control experiments.
You know, I have to say, I'm sorry, I actually don't know very much about that time of his life. I mean, I do know that when he, you know, that one of the things that he has said that came out of that is that he's always had a very difficult time sleeping because of those experiments. I mean, I'm afraid I don't really know very much about that part of his life. I apologize.
Maria Kramer, weren't you out here in Santa Monica covering this story?
Because I traveled to Santa Monica, you know, basically the day after they announced that he had been captured. So I was there Thursday morning. We arrived there just in time for the hearing in federal court.
And what was the sense of this fearsome figure, allegedly responsible for 19 murders? I take it what a stooped 83-year-old man showed up.
Well, yes. I mean, essentially what you saw, well, what was strange about his appearance is that, you know, he didn't act like a stooped, humbled man at all. I mean, if anything, he was kind of mocking reporters in court, you know, pretending like he was scribbling something down in a notepad and you know, making faces at reporters. He was joking back and forth with Catherine Gregg, you know, the woman with whom he escaped, or with whom he's been on the lam for so many years. He and she were joking back and forth as if they didn't have a care in the world. As far as his life in Santa Monica, what's strange is the way that many people really mourned the fact that this kindly neighbor of theirs was in fact an accused killer, an accused mobster. They described, you know, a nice, unassuming couple that, you know, blended in very well in the Santa Monica neighborhood, that went to the farmer's market and, you know, liked to go to the dollar store, liked to take long walks, and you know, and couldn't resist petting the dogs of you know, people walking down the street. I mean, these just sounded like very pleasant people. It was also interesting, what I found very interesting, especially when you think about Whitey Bulger's reputation in South Boston, was that he was looking out for people in the neighborhood. You know, he was giving flashlights to women who were wandering the streets, you know, alone at night, saying it's very dangerous, you shouldn't be walking around like this, and giving a bike-like to his next door neighbor because he rode his bike alone at night. So little things like that, and that sort of had these strange echoes to his reputation in South Boston, where he was very protective of this neighborhood that he at the same time terrified. So it was really interesting to sort of get that perspective from these people in Santa Monica, who obviously had no idea about his past and were very, 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 very shocked to find out that they'd been living alongside a notorious figure.
Well, the gentleman gangster, nevertheless, apparently, even though he protected the neighborhood while he was running the Winter Hill Gang, apparently he also, didn't he just decide one day that he wanted this bar?
liquor store,
these people. And I understand that all this cash that was found in the Santa Monica apartment, a lot of these people who lost their liquor store or their bar back in Boston are saying, hey, wait a minute, we want a piece of that cash.
A lot of people are actually saying that. I mean, you know, he left a lot of victims, and, you know, there are now victims' families are saying, you know, I don't want the government to get this money. You know, the government had a lot to do with this guy getting away. We should be getting the money. We're the ones that suffered the worst, of what this man had to offer the world. It's really interesting. We'll have to see. You know, one of the things that we're trying to find out now is exactly how much money does he have out there. He was making these strange jokes when he was in court in Boston on Friday, saying, "I will be able to pay for my case if you give me my money back." So that seems to imply that he probably has even more than $800,000.
Well, what do you make of the claim that he slipped back and forth into Boston at least, I think, once or maybe twice?
Yes, essentially what we found out in court papers yesterday was that he had come back to Boston wearing disguises, armed to the teeth. That was the exact language in the papers that the prosecutors filed in court yesterday, because he had, you know, quote unquote, unfinished business. And it's hard to think of what to make of it. I mean, could it be Whitey Bulger boasting, you know, saying, "I got one over you guys, and here I was going back to Boston without you guys even noticing"? But we did speak with one of his victims who had said that he saw him at the L Street bathhouse, which is a famous bathhouse here in Boston, saw him a couple of days before he was supposed to testify against him in that liquor store incident that you mentioned. And when he thought he saw Whitey Bulger, he got so scared that he decided not to testify. So it's really hard to figure out what to make of that, because, you know, on the one hand, could you think somebody would be so brazen as to come back to the city where he's wanted? But on the other hand, it seems like he was very confident and wasn't holed up in some cave. He was very much out there. You know, he in some ways almost wasn't trying to hide. It's fascinating.
Well, just in closing, Marie Kramer, since you cover crime for the Boston Globe, what's your sense of, and I'm harking back again to the Martin Scorsese film, where much of the story was told, although I don't think it was necessarily that faithful to the truth. But Jack Nicholson,
or the accents,
yeah, plays the Whitey Bulger character, and you see how violent he is. But in terms of who's the most violent, it's hard to know nowadays with the Russian mafia, the MS-13. But it seemed that Bulger was even more violent than the Italians, and that was the notion, at least in the movie, that that's how we took over the territory. Give us a sense, as a crime reporter, the relative nastiness of this guy.
Well, I mean, it's terrifying. You know, when you go back and you look at the pictures that we've been running on Boston.com, showing the pictures of all the victims and then what happened to them. I mean, you know, he tortured people for information before killing them. He strangled women with his bare hands. I mean, it's absolutely terrifying. It just reads like a horror film, you know, especially when you think about, one of his co-conspirators, one of his associates, I should say, Stephen the Rifleman Fleming, who testified during a civil trial against the government, that he lured these women, women that Whitey Bulger wanted killed, and to these rooms, and then Whitey Bulger would come out of the dark and essentially kill them. It's just terrifying, the details, and there's nothing like it now, thank God. You know, we haven't had stories like that in a long, long time. And as a crime reporter, when you go back and you read these things, it's just unbelievable to see these details. It's what he did to people, what he's accused of doing to people, is absolutely horrifying. And you can't make things up like this. I mean, this is just it's stranger than fiction.
And a far cry from the elderly gentleman who handing out flashlights in Santa Monica and patting dogs.
Very much so, yeah. And, you know, and somebody in Santa Monica said, you know, that there was this, one of the people I was interviewing who was telling me these stories said, you know, it's strange how on the one side he seems to be really protective of the people around him. And then a neighbor who was listening in on the interview said, or maybe he was just being controlling. And I thought that was a really interesting observation.
Well,
a way of exerting control.
Sure. Well, Marie Kramer, I thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Marie Kramer, who covers crime for the Boston Globe, and she was in the Boston courtroom where alleged mobster Whitey Bulger appeared before a judge. So what did we learn today on Background Briefing? Well,
We began talking with the head of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, Robert Johnson, about why it is that the president doesn't stand up to the Republican blackmail, where they're threatening to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States unless they get their way in cutting Social Security and Medicare. And meanwhile, of course, they refuse to even consider raising revenues, let alone taxing the top 1%. I mean, it is a shocking situation when you think about this insane blackmail that the Tea Party is and the Republicans are threatening in terms of the debt ceiling, which is largely bogus. But why the White House is buying into it? Well, his answer is that they need the $1 billion and that the people who control American politics are the top 1%. They're the ones with the money. I asked him about what about the other 92%. Apparently, they don't count. At least they're not organized and they're not angry and they're not focusing on the real target, which is to change the way politics are done in this country. And of course, that means overturning the recent Supreme Court decision in Citizens United. Then we talked with a professor of modern Greek history. He's a Greek, Theophanes Stavrou. He's the editor of the Journal of Modern Greek Studies, about his country. He admitted that one of the problems is that they don't pay taxes, and it's pervasive that they don't pay taxes. He's optimistic that they will pass this austerity measure while recognizing it as the European bondholders and bankers who are getting the money. In fact, they're being loaning money to themselves effectively, and that the Greek people are the ones that have to sacrifice. They're not getting a dime. That is very clear. Do the bondholders and the bankers who made these reckless bets, why should they be bailed out? That's a good question. And of course, the people and the previous government borrowed recklessly. The Conservatives, they're not even cooperating. So it was an interesting analysis of the current Greek situation. He's too optimistic, though. I think that the statistics are such that the Greeks will eventually default. Another loan package is going to be required soon, identical to the current one, and I don't see how they can really get over their 350 billion euro debt that's dragging them down. And then finally, we talked about Whitey Bulger, the FBI's top of the FBI's most wanted list after Osama bin Laden. And he's, of course, was arrested here in California. He showed up in court today in Boston. I talked to the crime reporter for the Boston Globe, Maria Kramer. It's a fascinating story about the wars between law enforcement, the Massachusetts State Police versus the FBI. The FBI are going to be deeply embarrassed by this trial. Obviously, there's a lot of dirty stuff that comes out, not the least of which that Whitey Bulger was also involved in the CIA's LSD experiments, and he created some contacts with the government. So that is the story which we're going to have to revisit later, because I think there's an awful lot more to this story. Normally we don't do crime, but crime involving the government cover-up is an interesting story. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank my producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. We had production help from Erica Rivera. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program and sign up for podcast at ianmasters.com. I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down in a minute.